Dec, thanks for coming on, mate. I know that you were busy travelling back from France last night, so I really appreciate the commitment. We've not had anybody on the podcast yet that's literally just competed, so I normally start with what you're up to, what's life like at the minute, but just tell me about the last week.
Yeah, so I just got back from France this morning, about sort of 1:30 this morning. So I was out there all week competing in a world tour event. So I managed to get to the final there, which was good. Lost out in the final, but good to put five matches together. You know, it's my second month back competing after the Achilles injury. So I feel good. I'm just happy to be travelling again and competing and back in the mix. You know, I definitely missed it. So yeah, I'm good. I'm in a good place. Yeah.
How long was it that you were sitting out on the sidelines and having to watch other people compete?
Yeah. So in the last couple of years, it's been a long chunk of time. This one was I ruptured my Achilles last November. You know, so sort of 13 months ago. Mm. I had the operation 10 days after the injury. So, you know, it was about 11 months out until I started competing again at the end of October. So a long old time. And then in April of 22, I also tore my quad.
Right.
Yeah, so I had a 3-inch tear in my quad, which went into the hip ligaments as well. So I had a few months out from that in 2022, just managed to get back for the Commonwealth last year and was then competing for a couple of months and everything was going great. And then the Achilles happened. So, yeah, in the course of the last 2 years, it's been a lot of injury, a lot of time away from the sport, you know, sort of career-threatening injuries as well, which is obviously concerning. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, I'm back and I'm... You know, ready to go again.
And are they typical squash injuries, Dec? Like a torn quad, an Achilles injury, you know, a torn quad especially. Don't hear about that much in sports that I've done myself, particularly not gymnastics. Are they quite typical in squash? Or?
So the quad injury I sustained when I was actually lifting in the gym,
right, okay.
Which was frustrating to injure myself in the gym because that shouldn't really happen. Mm. But squash is a massively quad-dominant sport, leg-dominant, the glutes, the quads, the hamstrings, they all take a huge, huge battering, the hips as well. And as regards the Achilles, yeah, there are actually a number of squash players that have ruptured their Achilles. Mm. A couple of the ladies at the top of the game have done it and come back to the top after doing it, which has given me quite a lot of encouragement, really. But yeah, it's with the Achilles, you seem to see it in the explosive sports. I don't know if it happens in gymnastics, but I've certainly seen it in squash. You see it in basketball a little bit. Track and field, I think you see it in a little bit. But yeah, really explosive sports where there's kind of fast twitch movements going on. You do tend to see it, yeah.
And when you ruptured your Achilles, Dec, was it a full rupture?
Mm.
And was it the classic gunshot that people talk about, sound that people can hear? Or
It's strange because mine, it didn't really make a loud sound.
Right, okay.
And it also wasn't all that painful.
Right.
I remember vividly how it felt. And I knew straight away what I'd done as well. As you know, I went down like a sack of potatoes and I knew exactly what happened straight away, but it wasn't that painful and again, it wasn't particularly loud. So it's a very strange feeling, but it, in a way, it helps when you know straight away. Mm. I mean, as you will know, we pick up niggles and minor injuries all the time and it's the not knowing how bad is it, how long am I going to be out for, that can often be the worst thing because you're waiting for that diagnosis, you're going to the physios and maybe sometimes they can't figure it out straight away. Yeah. But with an injury that serious, you know within a few seconds, I've ruptured my Achilles, the recovery time is going to be 9 to 12 months, that's just how it is, you can't rush Achilles recoveries. And so you kind of, it just left me at peace with it very quickly, right, okay. Because I knew what the damage was, so it's kind of like, well, there's nothing I can do about that now, so it's like, what's the journey and the process to get back?
Yeah, a really like methodical way of like looking at it. That was always one of the ones that scared me most when I was competing in gymnastics. It was an ACL tear or an Achilles, because the Achilles is quite common, and often in gymnastics it happens on the floor. So you were right, explosiveness.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And it sounds like the floor snaps.
Really?
So it sounds like there's a lot of wooden boards on the floor.
Because they were really springy in gymnastics,
they are,
right?
Springy, yeah. So you have like springs, foam and boards, like wooden boards. It's a combination of those three.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a board snaps. And then you often see them reach down for their Achilles.
Because you feel like you've been hit in the back of the leg.
Yeah, you see like the panic. Yeah. And that's what it often is. But Let's go back, Deck, to the very beginning. Mm. One of my friends once, we had a conversation, he was a gymnast as well, and he said, do you know how lucky we were that we were born so close to one of the best gymnastics clubs in the country, and then one of the best gymnastics coaches in the world came to live in Nottingham, and we were able to train with him, and then I had my parents that were very supportive of my career. When you look back at when you first got into squash, what were some of the stars that kind of aligned in your story when it comes to you starting in squash?
Yeah, there's definitely a few. I'm a big sort of believer in what you've just said about things having to come together. You know, where the park in Nottingham, which is 10 minutes away from where we are now, is or has been one of the best squash clubs in the country. One of the biggest facilities. And when I was growing up, I started playing at the age of 6. I actually started at a leisure centre, a Friesland leisure centre, sort of between Nottingham and Derby. Right. So my uncle sort of took me on court with one of those junior rackets that's like that long and just sort of said, here you go. And so my cousins, who are all 5 years older than me, they played, and my brother played a little bit. So definitely that family influence was the start. But then also, yeah, you know, 20 minutes away, I had one of the biggest squash clubs in the country at that time. And also at that time, you had a lot of the world's best players playing out of that club.
Oh, really?
Players, you know, in the top 10 in the world. So from the age of about 10 or 11, I was a member down there and got to go down there a couple of times a week. So I was exposed to what that level of squash looked like. And these guys that I looked up to who were there, ones at the top of the game, guys that are a few years older than me and the juniors who were playing at a good level. I was exposed to really good squash. And I think the support from my parents was another one of those things that aligned, because they just supported me tremendously with playing squash at the start. In those early years, it was going down to the leisure centre once or twice a week, and then it got to the point where I was kind of nagging, can we go to squash, can we go to squash? And it just sort of snowballed from there, and started playing sort of junior tournaments at 9 years old, and then you start travelling up and down the country, and then you go to a tournament in Europe and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it definitely spiraled from there, but for sure, there are a lot of things that aligned. I was taught at home as well.
Right, okay.
I was homeschooled for no particular reason, but that also allowed me to, you know, be able to put a lot of time in outside of that into squash and have a little bit more flexibility. So yeah, in those early years, there were definitely a number of things: location, family, support, that all aligned, which allowed me. And then also, right, like just a massive passion for it. Because I didn't go to school and I was homeschooled, I wasn't playing 5 sports as a kid. I think a lot of kids in at least in our country, they play cricket and football and, you know, track and field, whatever it is. They do a lot. They're exposed to a lot of sports at school, right? Mm. And so you might get a 10-year-old that's playing 2 or 3 sports and is pretty good at a couple of them and maybe has to decide or maybe doesn't want to. For me, it was only squash that I had been exposed to.
Yeah.
And I happened to be, you know, reasonably good at it from a young age. So, yeah, there were definitely a number of things that aligned that allowed me to go down that path.
Yeah. And when I think about squash, Dick, it's, you know, it's not a popular sport
amongst young people,
right? And we're actually, interestingly, the village that I live in, where we are right now, there is a squash club.
Mm.
And so I knew about squash just because my grandma and my uncle played squash and they went to that squash club.
Yeah.
But imagine if you're not born around a squash club, when are you ever going to try and play squash? You know, at school, it's not one of the sports that you would practice. So it's interesting that you say that. Is there like a barrier to entry in squash that exists in terms of, so in my sport, in gymnastics, financially, it's quite difficult.
Yeah.
Because it's quite expensive for parents to pay memberships. And if you've got 2 or 3 brothers and sisters that also want to do gymnastics, that can sometimes be tricky and difficult. And so you tend to get kids from a certain area that will go and do gymnastics. Mm. But for example, my gymnastics club, we used to outreach kids from inner city schools because they were always really, really talented.
All right.
But they struggled to be able to come and play do gymnastics because of the finances, that was a bit of a barrier. Is there any of that in squash? Or do you think it's just there's not a lot of squash players just because it's not really on TV as much? There's not as many squash clubs. Kids aren't trying it in school.
Yeah, it's more that those latter points that you mentioned. There's no real barrier to entry because it's kind of a working man's game over here. And it is, like you said, very much, oh, my dad plays squash or my uncle plays squash, or, you know, at the local leisure centre, pint after in the pub, that type of vibe. So, yeah, no barriers to entry. It's not an expensive sport to take up at all. Coaching isn't particularly expensive compared to things like tennis or golf, for example. So, yeah, I just think it's not a sport, like you say, that young kids look at and think, oh, I want to be a squash player. Because I think a lot of kids look up to personalities as well, right? They don't just want to be a footballer or a cricketer. They want to be like someone in that sport because they have these personalities to look up to. And I don't think the sport of squash does a great job of promoting the personalities and the players within the sport and making them people that kids want to then look up to and be like and emulate. So I think that's something that we can do a lot better as a sport, yeah.
Who were your big influences growing up, Dave? You obviously spoke about your parents there, and it sounds like being able to go to that club where there were some of the best squash players in the world probably gave you a massive advantage, right? Because you were seeing straight away, they train where I train, this is possible. So you saw that from an early age. Who were those big influences?
I mean, certainly in England, the two guys were James Woolstrop and Nick Matthew, who were two legends of the game, both world number ones. Nick was multiple world champion and Commonwealth gold medalist, as was James. And I am in the unbelievably fortunate position that James went on to become, or has become, my doubles partner.
Right.
And I was watching him on TV in the Commonwealth Games from the age of, let's say, 14, 15. Wow. He was like, you know, James is about 10, 11 years older than me. So he, you know, he was playing for a long time before I was at the very top of the game. So I was watching him on TV and just sort of idolising this guy, thinking, oh my word, the way that he plays the game, he was like a hero of mine. And then I was in the incredible position in 2017, going into the Gold Coast in 2018, that I actually got to play doubles with him. Which was unbelievable, and with Nick, he became my coach. So he retired, and then he started to do a bit of work with England Squash, our governing body, and I sort of just reached out to him, and he was, you know, he was happy to coach me. So yeah, and there's another guy, Amish Shabana, who's an Egyptian legend, four-time world champion in the sport, who I also looked up to, but I don't know him on a personal level. Yeah. So yeah, locally, the two guys that I looked up to, I've ended up having really close relationships with both. So again, and we're talking about those stars aligning, it was just another thing that massively helped me. I've been incredibly fortunate in my career with the way that certain things have happened, because, you know, it's funny how things happen, isn't it, like that?
Yeah, it is. And you talked about, you know, straight away then I'm thinking of the phrase that your idols become your rivals, right?
Yeah.
You know, your idols become your tennis partner. What an incredible thing. Did you have, when you first started playing with them, did you have those pinch me moments? Like, you're thinking back to when you were a kid and now I'm playing with this guy and we're on the same team.
Yeah, massively. Because when I was growing up through the juniors, we would get invited to kind of some of the England senior training squads when we were at a good enough level to be able to be on court with them. Maybe 16, 17 years old. If we were good enough, we'd get a bit of a chance to drop into a couple of the senior squads. And at that time, I remember seeing these guys and being quite sort of, you know, starstruck, sort of intimidated by, wow, because these are the guys that look up to, they're at the top of the game, and, you know, you're kind of there on the squad with them, you're on court with them, you don't want to mess it up, you want to just be like a good enough, you know, spar for them, so to speak. So that was crazy, yeah. And then when the Gold Coast game started to come around, and, you know, the potential was going to be there to get a spot in the doubles, I was kind of just angle. I was like desperate to get a chance just to play with James in practice, because what we do before the Commonwealth is a couple of years before we'll start doing doubles specific training, because it's only the real time that we play in the doubles. So we would do these practice sessions, and I remember just thinking, oh, just give me a chance with James, like, to the coaches, pair me up, and I'll, you know, just show that, like, I could make that partnership work. Because he was obviously, you know, one of the best players on the squad. And I was like, obviously, I want to play with the best player, right? So, yeah, that was how that kind of unfolded. But, yeah, it was definitely intimidating at the start, you know, seeing those guys and then being like, oh, actually. And I did get to compete against them a couple of times as well, but I much prefer being on the same side of the court.
At what point, Dec, like, in your career, did your life start to revolve around squash? Because it sounds like you start playing at six, pretty young.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of sports people aren't starting until they're teenagers.
Yeah.
It sounds as well because of the homeschooling situation that you had. Maybe you were able to train more than other people.
Yeah.
At what point do you really look back and go, right, at that point, it all became about squash?
Do you know what? I actually think that happened a little bit later on for me. I sort of cite the time that I was at college.
Okay.
I studied business at college in Nottingham for a couple of years after school. It was around 16, 17. And it was about that time that I started to think about playing squash professionally.
Right.
And that was probably just through a confidence thing or a lack thereof, maybe. Because I when I do things, I like to do them at 100%. And I only wanted to go and be a professional squash player if I thought I could be good enough to get to a level that I'd be happy with. I didn't want to go into squash just to be kind of a journeyman. Right. I've got the utmost respect for any of these professional players. But for me personally, I wanted to get to a level that I'd be happy with, and I wouldn't have even gone into it in the start if I didn't think I could. And so at 16, 17, I was probably one of the best juniors in the country, ranking-wise. And it was probably about that time that I thought, okay, maybe I can make a good go of this. I've never sort of understood, you know, the people that kind of say, oh, I was born to do this sport, or I was born to do that, or I just knew from the age of six that I was going to be a champion. Because it's like, well, how can you possibly know that at such a young age? For me personally, I couldn't understand that. So it took quite a few years on the junior circuit and growing up and maturing to make that decision. And then once I did it around about that age, then I was kind of, okay, full focus, training professionally, putting the hard graft in. But yeah, I would say it was later than most people would.
And was there, at that age when you were kind of starting to make that decision, was there an obvious career path at that point in squash to be a professional squash player?
Yeah, there was. I mean, it's you don't get into squash for money. Let's put it that way. There isn't that much money in squash in relativity to how hard the guys work and how athletic they are and how skilled they are. Squash players are incredibly tough cookies. They're very fit, very skillful. It's a brutal sport on the body. And yeah, the sort of reward isn't there in relation to how hard you have to work for it. But with that being said, you know, you can support yourself. You can support yourself through the playing league matches for different clubs, through prize money, through sponsorships if you're fortunate enough to get partners that come on board with you. So yeah, the path was there, but let's just say, you know, you're not going into it for the money. You're not going to be retiring from work at the end of a squash career. You know, it's just going to, but it is going to be a career that's incredibly rewarding in other ways, getting to see a lot of the world and getting to meet unbelievable people and just having a generally interesting life. I feel very fortunate that I don't have to just work the same kind of office 9-to-5, wait for the weekend scenario that, you know, a lot of people are maybe frustrated by. You know, getting to be an athlete and travel the world is, you know, money aside, is an incredibly fortunate sort of vocation. And that's not lost on me at all.
Do you know when you look back, Dec, at that time, you talked about the training being very, very hard. What was training looking like at that point, you know, when you're 16, 17? What's the typical training day of a professional squash player?
I remember when I was about 18, 19, not being physically strong enough for the demands of professional squash. I was a good junior, but when you're a good junior, you often get away with a lot because you're quite skillful or talented or whatever you want to say. And when you go into the seniors, it's a completely different game because you're coming up against men who are very strong. And, you know, the physicality is just, it's like I said, it's brutal. And it makes you realise how hard you actually have to work. And I remember, you know, playing my first couple of years on tour and it being obvious that I just wasn't physically strong enough, that I needed to work a lot harder. Okay. And my coach at the time said to me, you need to put in three hard summers, three hard years of graft to get to a level to be physically strong enough to compete with the top guys in the world. I say three hard summers because our season is kind of September to May time, and that June, July, August time that we call our off season is actually the hardest time of the year because it's where we do that off season training. You know, it's not a case of a month off and then come back for a couple of weeks of pre-season training. It's like 3 months of graft, hard. So I sort of had a decision to make at that time when I was 18, 19 of, do you want to go through the pain that it's going to take? And that's where I had to sort of, you know, mold my personality a little bit and really toughen up, because I just wasn't going to get to the level unless I did those hard yards. And so from that point onwards, it was, you know, are you working with a good trainer? Are you planning your week in the correct way? And really, you need to be at sort of two sessions a day, 6 days a week for the most part. I would have Sundays off, and two or three times in the week, you need to be, we call it going to the well, which is a sort of a saying in squash whereby you basically just emptying yourself in a training session, doing a reduction session where you're basically just in on the floor in a mess after. Right. And that might be... that might be ghosting movements on the court, which is basically where you're imitating a squash rally without the racket. So you're basically running around the different corners of the court pretending to hit a shot, but you've got no racket in your hand. You probably look a bit stupid to people that don't know what squash is, but it's a really tough exercise to do. Or for me, the treadmill sessions, I still do hate the treadmill, so there's a lot of that in there. Some of the bike sessions, into really hard interval training, you know, 3 minutes on, 90 seconds off, that type of stuff is what I sort of based a lot of my training around. And, you know, so you'd be doing sort of 2 to 3 sessions going to the well a week. You'd be playing two or three practice matches, and then a lot of technical sessions as well, solo practice where you're just practicing on your own, and a couple of strength and conditioning weights sessions in the gym where you're doing heavy lifting. And then alongside that, you've got to get your recovery bits in, your stretching, your rolling, your physio. It's tough. Listen, if you're training properly at that top level, like all sports, you know as well as I do, it's you have to put yourself in some dark places to be able to get to a point. And that isn't a guarantee to success, by the way. That's the barrier to entry. I've always said that. Just to get yourself a seat at the table, you have to be going in some dark places physically. From there, you might have a chance to do something. It doesn't mean you're going to achieve. It just means you've got half of a chance. Yeah. If you don't do that, don't even bother showing up, you know. And it's clear to see with the players that are prepared to go and put themselves in a hole, they achieve more over the course of their career because they're prepared to go to those dark places. If you don't do that, there's just no point showing up.
You know, it's interesting you're talking about that, the guy that you grew up watching, James Willstrop.
Yeah.
So he was how many years older than you?
About 10.
A 10. And so he's putting himself through all of this. Mm. He was doing that when he was your age. Mm. And so he's competing with you now. Commonwealth Games, you just won a gold medal. So he's 10, 11 years older than you.
Yeah.
Like, is there any... Do squash players show much wear and tear over... Because that is a long period of time to be doing that kind of a... That kind of a training schedule sounds brutal, to be doing that year in, year out. And I'm guessing that summer period is really where you're building the foundations then for the season, then you're back to it again the next year. It's kind of a conveyor belt that never stops, right?
It will taper off towards the latter parts of your career. Yeah, you won't be doing quite the same volume. You'll be still looking for the same quality, but it'll be a little bit less. You won't be doing, you know, twice a day, every day, 6 days a week at 35 years of age, for example. Right. James had a hip operation. He's had several injuries. Nick, my coach, he had a shoulder operation, was out for a year. He's had knee operations. It's very rare that squash players that get to the higher levels don't have at least one serious injury in their career. And I'm talking a year out, 9 months out, and surgery. Mm-hmm. But yeah, after 10 years of doing that, when you get into your 30s, it becomes a lot more about quality than quantity, because as rugged as squash players are, you know, your body can only take so much, right?
Are you aware of that now? Is that something you're very conscious of as you're entering in your 30s and you know that that period's coming? Is that something you're already thinking about? Do you have those conversations with your coach? Are you like, right, look, we want to have a long career. You know, it's just been announced, right, that squash is going to be the Olympic Games in 2028. Is that something you're very conscious of, trying to make your career last for as long as possible? Or are you still in a stage where, look, I'm coming back from the injury, I've still got a graft and I've got to work at this stage?
Yeah, it's a blend of both.
Okay.
It's a blend of both. The last couple of years have made me realise my mortality a lot more.
Right.
Because I had 10 years from 18 to 28 where I was pretty much injury-free. My body was very good to me. And I've always trained well and professionally. I've looked after myself, don't get me wrong. But it made me appreciate that run of relative clean health. It made me appreciate that, and having those two serious injuries in the space of a year and a half definitely made me realise, okay, you know, you're doing a pretty tough sport here. Let's sort of be clever as well as working hard. Let's work smart as well as hard. And now that I'm getting back to being physically complete again, I am still trying to put that graft in, because it's so hard to get back.
Yeah.
To that level, it's so tough, but I am trying. And I you know, as much as I think you want to err on the side of wanting to do too much and wanting to work hard as opposed to not wanting to work hard enough. I'm never going to create excuses for myself and say, oh, well, I'm 30 now, I've had surgery, I can take it easy, I can, you know, just, you know, I can let my body have a bit of a break. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in getting every last drop that I can out of myself. So I like to err on the side of that, but you've got to be honest with yourself, Sam, right? Yeah. Like, you know, if you're training hard enough, or if you're putting the sessions in, or if you're letting that little excuse come in and say, maybe I should just go a little bit easier this week because I don't want to get injured.
Yeah.
You've got to be honest with yourself. Yeah. Honesty. That's what it comes down to. You know how hard you can push yourself. Once you've had a few years on tour and 10 years of training, even from a junior, you get to know your body pretty well. You've worked with professionals your whole life, physios, doctors, strength and conditioning coaches. You've learned so much about your body, and you know what it feels like to push hard or to not push hard enough. Mm. So as long as you're honest with yourself, then I think you're going to be okay.
Where does the deck, you know, we've had a chat before and you told me that Team England is kind of where all the best squash players, that's the system that exists within squash, it's Team England, whereas, you know, Olympic sports, it's Team GB. That might be changing now, I don't know, I'm sure you could tell me.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about having a strength and conditioning coach, physios, doctors, is that something you're setting up yourself, you're self-funding that team around you? Or are you getting funding from Team England to help you do that? And is it people that work for, I don't know, maybe the EIS or Team England themselves?
Yeah, so it's a bit of both. Okay. So with Nick, my coach, that's like a personal arrangement. The one-to-one coaches are quite an individual setup,
right.
But all of the healthcare aspects, so the physiotherapy, the healthcare, the medical, that's all within England squash through the EIS, yeah.
Right.
So they have a partnership.
Okay.
Incredibly fortunate to have that, because, you know, I've got an unbelievable strength and conditioning coach. I've had great physios. My surgeon and the team who looked after me through my operation were world class. Very, very fortunate to have that through our sort of medical insurance, if you like, because that would have been an unbelievable thing to have to fund privately, because just the level of treatment that I had was amazing. So yeah, so it's a mixture of both.
What was your first big result when it came to yourself individually, outside of playing doubles? What was the first big kind of breakthrough where, you know, at 16, 17, you're thinking, right, I want to go and do this? What was the first kind of real evidence where you went, okay, right, I'm competing with some of the best in the world now?
I mean, when I was in that period of 18 to 23, 24, my first sort of 4 or 5 years on tour, I won quite a lot of lower level titles. I probably picked up 10 titles or so in those first few years. and got into sort of that top 50 in the world. I remember getting into the top 100 in the world and thinking that's a decent level. Because when I was a junior growing up, I looked at those players around 100 in the world and I thought, wow, like they're serious players. I wonder if I can ever get to that level. Yeah. And then I got to that level and I thought, okay, what's next? And then it's like, well, can I get into the top 50? Can I get into the top 20? And then I managed to achieve those sort of targets. And then after the Commonwealths in the Gold Coast in 2018, I won my biggest title that I'd won over in France again. And I actually played James in the final. That's one of the few times that we've played. So that was a nice moment in terms of, I'd have probably been happy winning or losing that match, to be quite honest, because we played a real high-quality match in an unbelievable venue. We were playing in an opera house over in Nantes in France, one of the best tournaments on the tour. They use a different venue every year. But the crowd was just... The French crowd are unbelievable. I don't know what it is, but they're just so intense and passionate. And yeah, so that was... So the biggest title that I've won on a singles basis was that one. So that was that was a cool moment as well. And then I suppose getting into the top 20 in the world was a good achievement as well. So yeah, there's been a few achievements along the way. I don't look at 10 different moments and say, oh yeah, that was awesome and that was great. I'm not interested in sort of, you know, shouting from the rooftop about everything that's happened. There's a couple of, you know, moments. And a lot of them have been in a team environment. I mean, we, as an England team, we got to the final of the World Team Championships in 2019. We lost to Egypt in the final, who are the strongest squash-playing nation in the world by a way at the moment. And we had a really good week as a team together there. And obviously the Commonwealth medals with James. It's funny. I sometimes wonder if I'd have been better suited to playing a team sport through my personality because I love the camaraderie and the doing things alongside other people. So I've always enjoyed that a little bit more. Squash is a very solitary sport, man. It's you're locked in a box for an hour and a half against another guy. You're in close quarters. It's close quarters combat without the impact. And it's lonely out there. Mm. It's real solitary existence. And you go away on tour, like France this week, for example. You travel on your own most of the time because squash players can't afford to take an entourage with them. Like tennis, you can't really afford to take your coach and your physical trainer and your psychologist with you on tour because of the costs. So the majority of the time you're traveling on your own. And, you know, I had an apartment this week in France on my own. And I was at the tournament playing matches on my own, no one in my corner or anything like that. And that's not to get a violin out or anything, by the way. It's just to say it's a really nomadic lifestyle. Like, you'll travel halfway across the world on your own, stay on your own the whole week, play your tournament and come home. So there's a lot of mental properties that are required. You know, you haven't got the support of your friend or your team with you all the time. So that just presents itself a bit of a different challenge to get used to. But it's good. I mean, I can't see anything bad that comes out of, you know, having to go through those adversities on your own sort of thing. I think it moulds you and it forges you through fire. So,
how important then, Dick, when you're doing that? Because that is tough. You know, I've done that before when you're hotel rooms by yourself. You go out, you train great, but then you're by yourself. There's no one else there. Mm. Going away without your coaches. How important is that relationship with the voice you have inside your head? Mm. How important is that?
Absolutely vital. And
have you found that difficult at times throughout your career? Has there been times where that's been tough? And, you know, because that lifestyle, it's quite a lonely lifestyle, isn't it? When you're doing an individual sport. Mm. I know at times you're playing doubles a lot of the time, but when it's just you and your own thoughts and you're putting a lot on the line, you've done all this training for, sometimes it can feel like, well, I'm making a big sacrifice here. This has got to work. You almost get to a point where you feel like, I have to make this work to justify the sacrifice. Do you know what I mean? So how important is that relationship?
The self-doubt's always there. The self-doubt's always creeping out. I've never really struggled with spending time on my own. I was a really insular kid.
Okay.
I was quite shy and reserved and kept myself to myself as a child. And I've always enjoyed my own company. So that side of it's not been too bad. I don't mind being on my own. I love being with people. I'm a very sociable person. I love being around people. But I'm also happy in my own company. So I think that's helped me because I don't struggle to if I'm not with people. But yeah, obviously being left to your own thoughts is another thing entirely. And you just have to learn how to control the mind, right? And I mean, I know that's a vague thing to say, but those negative thoughts, I think, are always going to be there. But it's just about how you handle them.
Right.
I try and embrace and lean into whatever comes my way inside the mind. I think if you try and shut thoughts out, that can be dangerous in itself. And I believe that we're in a position where we're fortunate to have to deal with these different thoughts and emotions. How unlikely is it that I have become a professional squash player, that you've become a professional gymnast, that we've been able to have these lives? How unlikely is that? I mean, it's ridiculous when you think about it. You spoke at the start about the stars that have to align. And, you know, it's you can't overstate how true that is. How many things have to happen for you to even just be a professional, let alone do it internationally, you know, have the successes that you've had, the successes that I've had. That in itself is, it's mind-blowing. And I think you have to take gratitude out of it. And just, you know, when those negative thoughts are there and you're sort of questioning yourself, you just have to remind yourself of how fortunate you are to be in that position in the first place. It's like, well, would you rather just never have been in that position and never had to question yourself or have a chance to achieve something and just live a really mundane life? Like, would you rather be in that position? I think when all is said and done, probably not. So, yeah, I try and lean in towards being grateful for the situations that I've been in. It takes me back to the injury as well, because the thing that I got asked probably the most post-injury was, how did you cope mentally? Because everything's about mental health now, isn't it? Like, everything's about how do you feel? How do you feel? It's like this snowflake generation when how you feel is the only thing that, that is important. And it's like, it's just, I just don't look at the world that way. And so people said to me, how did you feel mentally? Like, were you in a dark place? Were you in a dark place after the, and I said, and this is like the honest truth. I didn't allow negative emotion to enter my mind for 1 second. For 1 second. In fact, it made me grateful. I took gratitude out of the injury because I looked at the end of that year of 2022, and if you'd have said to me, you're going to get a gold medal in the Commonwealth Games alongside your childhood hero, but you're going to be out of the year a couple of months later, you're going to have had the injury beforehand, you're going to have competed for about 3 months in total in the whole year, but you're going to achieve that, I would have signed up for it every day of the week. Maybe my mindset would have been different if we didn't have that bit of success in Birmingham. But I was kind of sat there at Christmas time last year, sort of in my apartment with the cast on my leg. And I was just incredibly grateful for the situation that I'd been in. Because it's like, well, wow, that really just sort of puts a light on the things that we have managed to achieve, you know. And yeah, there's going to be a long road ahead to get back. But what a position you've been in and how fortunate you've been to live and lead the life that you have. So there are many people in the world that are going through a lot bigger problems than having a surgery for an injury because you get to play sports professionally for a living. I mean, it's ridiculous to just say it like that. So absolutely no interest in sitting at home with self-pity or feeling sorry for myself or why has this happened to me or I didn't deserve this. It's like, you don't deserve anything in life. You work hard at everything that you do. And maybe good things will happen. Life is, without sounding, you know, without sounding sort of or dark and depressed, life is suffering for the most part. And that's just the way it is. You know, you work hard for things, you suffer a little bit, then you get a bit of reward maybe, and then you keep working hard. But I was listening to, I was watching Dave Goggins last night. He put up a new reel on Instagram. I love that guy, man. I love the reels. And last night he said, suffering has no expiration date. Yeah. And I watched this reel a couple of times on loop and I was like, wow, that's like, I just found it really profound. Yeah. It was like, suffering has no expiration date. You know, when the failures come, you've got to keep getting up time and time again. And that's just the circle of life. That's how it is. You've got to keep working hard, keep getting back up, keep going again. And then there's going to be some more suffering, and then you've got to keep working. And that's the way that I choose to look at life, for better or for worse. It's not, you know, there's other opinions are available, but yeah. That's just the way that I look at things. And it allows me to rationalize, I think, when things go well, try and stay level-headed. And when things don't go well, try and stay level-headed. It's like Anthony Joshua always said about never let success get to your head or failure get to your heart. That's another quote that I've always been, that always clicked with me. And so I remember when the injury happened that night, I was on court playing a match, and a couple of people messaged me after who were at that particular match, and they were like, oh man, you like, I can't believe what your attitude was like when you got injured. Like, you were just so stoic about it, and almost like you didn't bat an eyelid, you know, you didn't cry, you didn't get angry or upset. And I was like, well, you know, why would I? You know, why am I going to allow that negative emotion to come into the mind? What good is that going to do? How is that going to serve me? There's absolutely nothing that I can do about the situation that I'm in now except try and recover. You know, that's happened. So the negative emotion is going to not serve me well at all.
It's amazing just listening to all of that, mate, because I resonated with so much of it. And I do think that when I got towards the end of my career, particularly the last 2 years, I'd made that switch, and kind of like the switch that sounds like you've already got in your head of, I'm just very grateful. Like, this is so ridiculous. I'm getting paid to do complicated cartwheels. This is just like, it's amazing that I'm able to do this. And towards the end then, when I would go in to train, and that negative, kind of almost that voice in my head that wanted to position myself as the victim,
yeah,
I'd laugh at him and go, what are you talking about? No one's making you be here.
Yeah.
Like, you can leave right now, but you're choosing to be here. Don't complain, you know. And it took me a long time to get to that point. And it sounds like you speak very well, and you're quite mentally mature. Do you think it's an advantage in squash that it sounds like your careers last for a lot longer than a lot of other sports? So you're able to mature more as your career's going on.
Yeah.
And almost see things slightly differently, because I do think that gratitude is probably the one thing that I know we're going to talk a little bit more, that I'll come away with today, is really, like, I've resonated with that. It's just that gratitude and not making the mistake of jumping to, why has this happened to me? Why have I got injured? Poor me. Because as soon as you make yourself a victim, right, you take away the power. You then don't have the control to sort it out. Once you realise, right, there's things that I can do to get myself out of the position that I'm in, you then give yourself that power back.
It's, without going all political, it's the reason I've got such a problem with, like, woke culture and, and woke mentality, because it's this idea of victimhood. And I feel offended and I feel oppressed and this thing that's bad has happened to me. And I just don't subscribe to it. I mean, I'm not sure if you've read a book by Viktor Frankl called Man's Search for Meaning. I recommend everyone read it. It sort of changed the way that I look at life. And he spoke there words to the effect of, everything can be taken from a man except the last of the true freedoms, the freedom to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. So he's basically saying that whatever happens to you in life, you can't control everything, but you can control your attitude to what happens and how you react. And that's kind of, for me, the last true freedom, because it's like, well, bad things may happen. I may get injured. You know, something bad may happen. Personally, I might go through a tough time. You can't control that. Yeah. But how you react in your mind and how you respond and forge a path forward, that is how you can, you know, remain free. And so my perspective has definitely changed from when I started as an 18-year-old playing professional squash. Back then, it was very much about results are everything. And there is still an element of that, because we're in a results-based business. I'm a realist. I'm a realistic person. I know that achievements matter and results do matter. But they matter in terms of, how much can you get out of yourself? Can you leave it all out there? They don't matter in terms of, what are other people going to think of me? And that's something that I struggled with when I was younger because I wasn't all that confident.
Okay.
I lacked a lot of self-belief. And I still have those doubts to this day, by the way, but I just am a little bit better at dealing with them. And so everything was centered around results, ranking, get to this, get to that, because then people will accept me and all the rest of it. And, you know, it's like, for me, your perspective on things will either be your prison or your passport. You know, you can either allow them to hold you back or to push forward and forge forward. And so the older that I got, the more that I realised it was about just doing the best that I could at whatever it is that I'm doing, leaving it all on the table, creating memories, having things to look back at, making the people and the team around me proud. And in a way, I think that can be quite freeing when you do that. You don't put, you have to put pressure on yourself because pressure is a privilege. So you need to embrace that. But ideally not to a point where it has a negative effect on performance. I think a bit of pressure is good. I think a bit of pressure is really good. But just, you know, the right amount so that you still have a perspective on things.
Yeah. How easy is it you to transition into playing doubles?
It's a very different game.
Right.
It's a very different game. As I say, we only really play it at the Commonwealth, so every 4 years, and they have a World Doubles Championships as well. It's mentally a very different. It's mentally very draining. The court is at least 30% wider.
Right.
The tin, which is the part of the front wall that the ball has to go above, is a lot lower.
Okay.
So the shots stay a lot shorter up the court. And the angles are completely different as well. There's a lot of play down the middle of the court, whereas in single squash, you want to get the ball onto the side walls, nice and tight, as we'd call it. In doubles, there's a lot of angles around the middle, and it's very fast fire. You can be a great singles player. If you've never played doubles before and you play doubles for the first time, you're probably going to be a bit all over the shop. So you do need quite a bit of practice, which is what we've done consistently, you know, since I've started on the Commonwealth journey. You know, there's been a lot of attention to detail in the practice, a lot of watching videos and specific drills and stuff. So, yeah, it's mentally taxing. It's not physically taxing because you've got four people on a court, so you're covering half the amount of space that you normally would. And because of how intense the singles is, the doubles is physically quite comfortable by comparison. But if you play a doubles match, and the tough doubles matches are, again, an hour and a half, you'll come off at the end of it and you'll just... the brain fog will be immense.
Right.
I wrote a blog after the 2018 Commonwealth Games, which was my first experience. We lost in the semi-final to our teammates.
Right.
And we had three match balls. So that was a real heartbreaking experience for me. One of the toughest moments of my career, you know, really heartbreaking. And then we bounced back the next day and we won the bronze. And I wrote a piece after that about the emotions. And I think it was called something like the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. Because the variety of emotions that I experienced in 24 hours was just wild. I mean, I remember playing this 90-minute semi-final marathon against our teammates, losing after having match balls, and just thinking that, like, the world was falling down. It was like just the end of the world. And I went back. The match was in the afternoon. I remember this vividly. The match was in the afternoon. I went back to the athletes' village after. It was about 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I just went straight to bed. I went straight to bed, and I was asleep for about 3 hours. Just and not from the physical, because mentally it had taken so much out of me. I mean, I'm a good sleeper. Like all my friends, it's a bit of a running joke that I love a sleep. And I mean, it was just, that's just mentally how taxing it was. And I remember just going through that and then waking up the next day and thinking, oh, I've got to do it all over again. Yeah. And drag yourself back out there. But it's, yeah, that kind of sums up for me what squash is. It's kind of chess on legs. It's a bit of a mental war, yeah.
And I'm guessing there's no one that just plays doubles?
No.
So
no.
You're singles, and then occasionally you'll play doubles just at Commonwealth Games?
Yeah.
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 when you look back at that year last year, because you won a world gold medal as well.
Yeah.
In your sport, in squash.
Mm.
So in my sport of gymnastics, world championships and Commonwealths is... The Commonwealths is on TV and it's a big deal and it's on BBC. But there are not many teams that compete in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the world championships is considered to be a lot greater achievement. What's that like in squash?
It's the other way around.
Other way around.
Other way around, yes. The world championships is kind of like a feeder event to set the seedings for the Commonwealths. It doesn't quite have the history. It's not been going on for as long. So it doesn't have the prestige. I mean, a world title is a world title, don't get me wrong. It's great and everything, but it's not, yeah, it's not something you'd rest your hat on as an achievement. The Commonwealth for us is, I mean, still a lot of the best playing countries, Egypt, France, aren't in the Commonwealth, so you have to take that into consideration. But for me personally, and what I want to achieve personally, there's nothing bigger.
Yeah. Right. And just tell me a little bit, Dec, about, you know, squash being put into the Olympic programme for LA.
Mm.
What does that mean for your sport?
It can be groundbreaking if we use it in the correct way. The reason I say if is because, you know, we've made the habit in the past of not capitalising with the sport of squash. It's a great product. I don't think that the game itself doesn't need changing or tinkering with, but it needs promoting in a more commercially modern way. The way that you look at boxing and darts and what they're doing with the TV and the production and making it like an event to go to, a night out with your friends, with the work, whatever it is. Other sports do a much better job at promoting their sport to the masses than we do.
Right.
We need to do a better job at that. And I'm hoping that this Olympic inclusion allows us to do that. I'm hoping it brings in bigger companies and brands, because the Olympic status is it's a massive thing in itself, isn't it? It does allure big brands. Let's see. The sport is great. People that go and watch squash, I think, are often left thinking, I really enjoyed that, and I'm quite impressed by what these guys are doing. We need to get that out there. We need to promote it in a better way. But it can be groundbreaking for the sport, yeah.
Does it mean that you're going to have a GB setup or not?
Yeah, it will be. Right. We don't know what that looks like yet, because it hasn't been decided, but it will be. And, you know, England, Wales, Scotland all have world-leading players. So that's going to make the hunt for selection even more fierce than it is. I mean, England has a big depth of players, and I would imagine there's only going to be two or three from each country in the men's and the women's. It's only singles, as I understand, so far.
Right.
So, getting selection is going to be brutally tough, but it's obviously something that I've got to aim for, because I don't think it would come in my career, to be honest. I don't think it would come. I'll be 35 then, so at the top end, but it's still possible to put out, you know, top-level squash at 35.
Has that become all of a sudden like a big goal for you?
It's become a distant goal.
Okay.
It's not become the only thing. The goal for me of late has been health and getting back playing and injury-free and moving well. That's been the main goal, and still is, and will be for the next number of months. But yeah, it has become a distant goal. If there was a time where I thought about retiring at 34, 33, that's now certainly been put back, because you have to try, right? Like if I don't make it to LA, then I'm not gonna end my career with regret, but if I didn't try, maybe I would.
Yeah. And now you've started playing again after your injury, how do you feel out on the court?
I feel good, and I didn't underestimate how hard it would be, but the one thing that's just been brutally hard to get back is match intensity and practice.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you can relate to that in terms of the difference between your training routines and maybe doing it like a practice run for how you do a run in competition versus then doing it competitively. But, I mean, I've done some tough work in the gym. I've gone back into some dark places that I've not explored for a couple of years. And, you know, as hard as I've trained, it still just doesn't prepare you for adrenaline, nerves, pressure, wanting something, right? It's like, why is it so different when all of a sudden the lights are on and the ref calls the score and there's something on the line? But I suppose that is the reason why it means something if you win. Like, if you didn't feel nerves and pressure and adrenaline, and you then achieved a tournament win or you won a good match, would it mean the same thing? I don't know.
And it's very difficult to replicate that last part, that last piece of the puzzle when you're coming back from an injury, which is competing at a high level. You just can't do it in the gym, training, you can't. It's a very different analogy, but, you know, like I was telling you before, I now play 7-a-side. And at the start of the season, I tried to play 11-a-side. And I just came on for 20 minutes. And 5 minutes in, I was looking around going, how have they played for 75 minutes at this intensity? It's just the speed, the aggression. I was like, wow, this is just a different level. There's levels to everything. It was the same in gymnastics. Like, I would come back, but even being fit enough to do the 2-hour warm-up before I went out to do the 4-hour competition and be mentally as switched on in the sixth hour as I was in the first minute, there's no way I can replicate that other than competing again and just getting out there and playing. So I'm guessing that's your plan, is to just get out, play, and build that back up again.
Absolutely, yeah. I've played 4 tournaments now since last month in the comeback. I am flying out to Qatar on Friday for the last one of the year. So, yeah, to get 5 events in at the end of the year is a good achievement for me. To play 5 matches last week in France was a good achievement. So, hoping that there's a lot more to come. Just you know, enjoying, having that enthusiasm. It's giving me that enthusiasm back and that keenness back, the attention to detail and the, you know, raring to get to training, not just going through the motions at times. The real, you know, I'm buzzing to be back and buzzing to be here and travelling and staying in one place for a year kind of really made me realise how much I love travelling and being around. As much of a nomadic lifestyle as it is, it kind of made me grateful for the fact that we get to move around and get back to doing what we do so much and being a squash player again. So obviously so many people have been saying, oh, how's it going, when are you going to be back, and how's the squash? And to be honest, it makes me think on a slightly different topic. Something that I wanted to ask you about was like identity. And you might have a better perspective of this now that you're post career than I do, but something that, it's not something that I struggle with, but I've always wondered why people will sort of label you as the Sam the gymnast, the squash player. If friends introduce you to their friends, it's like, oh, you're the squash player. And I sort of wonder how you deal with that identity side of things, and if you have interests outside of your sport, which I'm sure you do, I do, cars, fashion, whatever it is, books, and you're doing other things, and then people are like, no, but you're the squash player, why are you doing that? Is that something that you think about?
It's interesting, mate, because I did struggle with that, particularly when I was competing, particularly when I was younger, because my granddad, for instance, you know, Sam the gymnast, he's like, it's me as well, grandpa, because that, all of, I just took that as pressure straight away.
Yeah.
So, like, he's telling all his friends that I'm this great gymnast, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to... And I found that very hard.
Yeah.
But at the end of my career, I got to a point where I was able to detach myself from that identity and realise that gymnastics was just the way I chose to express who I was.
Yeah.
But I could have picked anything else.
Yeah,
I could have decided to be a plumber or a bricklayer or play golf, but I'm still me. And I'm expressing myself through that thing, and I just love to do it. And that detachment was really healthy for me. But that was a long process, and I had to go to some dark places to get to that point to be able to do that and almost not care about how other people saw me and fundamentally just be bothered about how I saw myself. I think it was, you spoke about that a little bit in the podcast. I was very deeply insecure when I was probably the most insecure teenager I've ever met. People wouldn't have known that on the outside, but on the inside I was. And that was very difficult growing up. I was constantly trying to please everybody else and just try and fit in and not stand out, you know. Polar opposite to that. Kind of now, I don't really care what people think of me much, as long as my family and my friends think I'm a good person, that's it. But you know, I don't care what my missus thinks about my haircut, or do you know what I mean? She'll give me grief if I have a buzz cut, but I also don't care.
Yeah
As long as you think I'm a good person. But as I was growing up, that was just completely intertwined with whether or not I was a good athlete or not. But the mistake I made was from the age of about 11, I decided that I'm going to be the Olympic champion and I'm going to measure my success in life off whether I do that or not. So I was always going to fail.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I've spoken about it before, but I had a real moment where I was sat having therapy where I kind of like was just looking out of the window and I just said, I've done this all wrong. I've got it all wrong. I've got this completely wrong. And I need to really just switch the whole way I like approach life after this. And I was able to do that. And actually, I often say that's probably the bravest thing I've ever done because the easiest thing for me to do was to just carry on doing what I was doing because that was safe.
Yeah.
But actually going, do you know what? Even if this means I'm not going to go and achieve this thing that I've set out to do and, you know, I've dreamt of when I was a kid, you know, I don't think I'm willing to take that risk. It's a bit like what you said, like, you have to pick something where you can justify the sacrifice and completely have an expectation that it might not happen. Does that make sense?
Like, it does, yeah.
It's like what you were talking about. You said, like, you can do all of the work.
Yeah.
You can work as hard as you possibly can, but you need to know it still might not work out.
Yeah.
I was doing all of the work, but I had this faith that it's going to work out. It has to work out, do you know what I mean? And it became something that my dream to win an Olympic gold medal, it wasn't a positive thing. It was a very negative thing. It was, I need to do this just to justify all the pain and suffering, which is not a great place to be coming from, do you know what I mean? It's not a positive springboard to be starting your day with or just even a way to approach life. So, yeah, I did struggle with that, but I've managed to detach myself from that a little bit more. And I now just spend my time doing things that I really enjoy doing, that I enjoy doing. And it doesn't need to be something that others think is great or that needs to make me loads of money or any of that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? But I do say to people, like, I feel very lucky because I feel like I have the gratitude that you talk about. My gratitude came from a place where I reached my rock bottom, and my rock bottom was I was very unwell and I was pretty suicidal. So after that point, my gratitude in life comes from a couple of times a week I will genuinely stop and say to myself, I'm so happy I'm here, man. I can't lose. I've won, like, because I could easily not be here anymore. And like, I love life so much, so there's not really much to complain about. It's been interesting. This has probably been the most full life year of life I've ever had. So much has happened this year. Like, I'm probably going to do a podcast episode on it, but, you know, I've had my granddad, who's my best friend, has passed away. I've started my own business. I got engaged. I'm having a baby. There's a lot going on with my family, a lot of stress financially, all of this stuff in just 1 year. But through all of it, I've managed to remain quite stable. I'm like a stable person. It's interesting. I listened to Jordan Peterson once talk about, one, if you're really struggling in life and you feel there's not much that you can do that's worthwhile, one thing you can aim for is to be somebody at a funeral that people can depend on. Just a very simple thing. So you could be someone at a funeral that people can lean on if they're struggling. And I was like, God, what a great thing that is to do. And I tried to do that at the start of the year with my granddad, to be the person. It doesn't mean that you don't show emotion, but I was like, God, if I can be somebody that, like, all the people around me that are really struggling with this can lean on, that's a great thing to do. Just a simple thing. And so now, yeah, for me, mate, it's just all about the very simple things in life, what's important to me. And yeah, it's a long way of answering your question, but it's interesting. Not a lot of people ask me questions back, but yeah, it is something I massively struggled with, that identity crisis. But it seems to me like you have a high level of self-awareness and you're already figuring those things out while you're still playing. And I would say that the best thing I ever did was kind of deal with my demons before I finished my sport, because I'm now at peace.
Yeah.
And I can look back at it and I don't forget the bad things, but I can see all the good. The bad disappears, you know? And that's an amazing thing that, you know, I'm so grateful I'm able to do, because a lot of my friends, a lot of teammates, a lot of other sportsmen that I speak to, you can see that regret in their eyes when they talk to you, you know?
Yeah, I kind of wonder how hard it is for some athletes when they stop and they talk about kind of getting the into bad places mentally when they stop and they've had all the highs. I mean, I can't imagine what it must be like for these footballers and basketball players that go out in front of 50,000 people every week. I mean, the highs, they're ridiculous. I mean, as an athlete of any level, your life is like that, right, as opposed to if you maybe just had a 9-to-5 and you had quite a linear job, your life probably looks like a horizontal line in terms of emotion, and then you might get some personal stuff that brings little peaks and troughs. You might have your holiday that gives you a nice little... As a squash player, as an athlete, it's literally that, which is a crazy way to go about life, because I remember a tennis player once saying that you have to get used to losing every single week, because unless you're winning every tournament you play, you are losing every week at some point. You can be getting semi-finals, quarter-finals, finals. Unless you win every single week, which pretty much no one ever does, you're having to deal with losing every week. So you're getting these tremendous highs of going to these places and meeting these people, winning these matches, maybe winning a tournament, and then you've got these massive loads of losing, and oh, this sucks, like, I hate this. And so the emotional roller coaster is tremendous. And you, as an athlete, you just have to get used to dealing with that. And I kind of wonder that when a lot of athletes get towards the end of their career, and then all of a sudden it's kind of that, and almost that can be unstable in itself.
Yeah.
Because the emotions aren't going up and down anymore. They're just very... So what can you get excited about?
Yeah.
There's nothing to get disappointed about, but there's nothing to get excited about. And
but
so
I think then that comes to... You know, you've talked a lot about, and I said already, I'm going to take that gratitude away. It just comes from just appreciating the small things.
Yeah.
Just the small things, man. Like, a great cup of coffee. Amazing.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing that my fiancé loves about me the most. I get so excited over the small things.
Yeah.
Like, I really like, wow, how great is this cup of coffee? And she's like, what? And I'm like, it tastes amazing. Like, this is brilliant. Yeah. It's like the best part of my day. Like, not, it's again, it comes back to not letting the highs get to you and not letting the lows get to you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the same with other people's opinions. You know, whether someone thinks you're the best thing since sliced bread or that you're a piece of shit, just level.
Yeah.
It's yourself, what do you think of yourself?
Yeah.
You know, and I think you're well equipped, mate, to deal with that time when it comes. It's great that, you know, I now... It's interesting, right? A lot of athletes do turn to gambling, drink, drugs.
Mm.
They come back, make a comeback, because they miss that high.
Sure.
You have to fill that gap. You know, for me, it's now about, like, I exhausted gymnastics. And that doesn't mean that I got to the very highest level. I didn't, you know. I never went and won an Olympic gold medal. But I did it for so long. Now, that was a part of my life that I've left behind there, and it was a great part of my life. Amazing. It's, you know, it's a big part of who I am, but I'm now on to the next thing. And I see the next adventure, having kids and, you know, building a new career. That's more exciting to me than that, you know? It's just a different part of my life, and I, you know, I still have to get that competitive edge out, whether it's playing seven-a-side football or going to the gym and lifting weights. For me, exercise will always be a massive part of my life, but I think sport, for you, will have equipped you with all of the important life skills you need to handle normal life.
Mm.
Sport is a metaphor for life, right?
Mm. Like,
there's not many places you can go anymore. I'm not sure if you quite get that in school. You know, yourself, you were homeschooled. I was homeschooled for a couple of years. You can learn all the things you need to learn about life through sport. And you can meet all the different types of people you're going to come across in life in sport. And actually, I think a lot of sports people are well equipped to adapt. It's just that initial period is a real shock. But if you prepare for it before it happens, you're in a much better place. And one thing I did towards the end of my career was kind of watch the people that were a few years older than me that started to retire and just see the moves they were making. And I started to transition before I finished, and that made it a lot easier.
Mm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. And again, it's about perspective. My sister-in-law is a psychologist, and she always told me, you know, what are you going to do after squash? And have you thought about, you know, what you're going to look like as a person? And I think having that knowledge sort of equipped me to just think about it and set the wheels in motion and have that self-awareness that you're not going to be a squash player forever, but it's also not who you are as a person. Mm. It's not your identity. You are Deck, the uncle, the brother, the son, the friend, not the Deck, the squash player. Yeah. And I think that really helped me just to put things into perspective in a better light and make me realise that I always like to say to people there is in the squash world, there's more to life than squash.
Yeah.
When I see people like my training partners or people I'm sort of friendly with, if I see they're down about something or they've had a bad week on tour, I sort of say, more to life than squash, mate. Yeah. Not in a sarcastic way or a sort of begrudging way. It's like, you know, we're just so fortunate to achieve.
Mate, I would do the same thing. Yeah. I'd say to people, you're just doing cartwheels, man.
Yeah.
It's not that important.
Yeah.
Like, I used to say to my coach when I was younger, I used to say, Sergey, imagine if, because I'd trained my whole life for this Olympic Games, right? And he'd done the same thing pretty much. And he was now vicariously living that dream through me. I said, what happens if World War III breaks out tomorrow and the Olympic Games is just gone? I've trained my whole life for this one thing. It doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
And it kind of happened with the pandemic, right? And it was a real good eye-opener, and you're right. And I think having that attitude, it doesn't mean that, you know, I got to a point where when I was in the gym and I was doing gymnastics at the end, it meant everything to me and I put all of it into it.
Yeah.
But it also didn't mean anything at the same time. It's like that paradox. Yeah. I think if you can get to that point...
Love that.
Brilliant, because you're there. You at that point, you're on a different level to other people, because it really does. You know, I've had so many athletes on this podcast, and you know, physically, especially in a sport like yours, where you've got a world ranking, I'd imagine on any day the top 10 might be able to beat each other, right? But it really comes down to here, like up there. That's the big difference, and I think that attitude for me, It helps alleviate a lot of that pressure you pile onto yourself, and you can go out there and just play then, rather than thinking about outcomes and whatever it is and the pressure. And if I do this, I've got to just go play, do your thing. I used to say to myself, the last thing I would say to myself, which was really weird because I did this for the last probably 5 or 6 years of my career, and then it became a quote on the new Top Gun film when I was watching it. But before I would be put up onto the high bar's high, right? 2.8 meters in the air. So my coach would lift me up. And the last thing I'd say to myself was, don't think, just do, because I'm a thinker. And it was just, don't think about it. Just perform. Get out of your own head. That's what I was saying to myself. That would be the last thing I'd say. So yeah, if you're able to do that, just perform. Don't think. I always perform my best at that moment. And I had those almost like out-of-body experiences where it was like autopilot, you know. You must have had it before where you've hit a shot and it almost feels like you didn't even hit it.
Of course.
It's like, you know, you catch the bar. Like, I can't even feel it. It was just, yeah. So, that's what I'd probably say on that.
The way I relate to what you've just said there is like letting go. And I find that so hard to do. Like ceding control of what you're doing. And it's kind of like, some of the best performances that I've ever had have been where I've just sort of let it be.
Yeah.
Just let
I think because you're in an individual sport, the temptation is to control.
You want to control everything.
You want to control every variable because you know no one else is going to care about this as much as I do.
Exactly.
So I don't trust anybody with...
Yeah.
But actually being able to step back and go, right, whether it's your coach, physio, you know more than me.
Yeah.
I'm going to listen and I'll do what you say. And that makes it much easier because you don't have a responsibility for every aspect. Your responsibility is to do what you're told to do and go out there and perform, and the rest is for everybody else. I think if I could have, I tried to be my own agent, nutritionist, physio. It's just too much. You can't do that. Like, no one can do that on their own. And even if you're in an individual sport, you cannot do it on your own.
Nah.
You need other people. Nah. Always be open to learning. Deck, just to finish off, mate, heading into a new year, what are your hopes for 2024?
Honestly, a season without any breaks and injury, you know, through the pandemic scenario and 2022, I've not played a full season on the World Tour since 2019, 4 years ago, going to be 5 years. I just want to play a full season because I know that there's performances left in my career and there's achievements to be had. And I'm a very achievement-motivated person. I don't care so much for now, at least, what people think or external reward. I care about what can I achieve and what can I look back on and be proud of and have memories. And I think there's a lot still in the tank. And I know that if I can get a full season, a full year of relative health, I'll be able to put my best foot forward. So really and truly, it's health and well-being and having my body in a good enough shape to compete for prolonged periods of time.
Brilliant, mate. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Appreciate it.